This is the Annex, a sociology podcast. I'm Dan Morrison from the University of Alabama in Huntsville. Today, we talk with two special guests, Dr. Anna Muller, the Luther Dana Waterman, Associate Professor of Sociology at Indiana University, and Dr. Seth Aberton, Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of British Columbia. Muller and Aberton are co-authors of Life Under Pressure, The Social Roots of Youth Suicide and What to Do About Them, which comes out March 6th from Oxford University Press. Our conversation was recorded on February 29th, Leap Day 2024, Community Culture, Conformity, Achievement, and Suicide on today's Annex. Stay with us. Well, Seth and Anna, it's so good to have you here on the Annex. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks, Dan. It's great to be here.
Yeah, super happy to be here.
And you've both been on before in the long ago days, the pre-COVID days, and we're really happy to have you here to talk about your new book and this project that's been going for some time. You've been collaborating on it for a while, as the book suggests, and I was really, really happy to read a copy, to get my little hands on a copy before the publication date, which is always really fun and nice. So I appreciate you all sending it. I want to get one thing out of the way first. For those who do not know, it is a myth that talking about suicide causes people who are thinking of suicide to attempt it. In fact, the research suggests that the opposite is likely the case. This fact is reflected in one of your takeaways from the last chapter of the book, which is discuss suicide openly without romanticizing it. So as we get started, what are some other myths out there that we should challenge just at the outset?
That's a great way to start, Dan. You know, I think it's just to even elaborate on the one myth that you raised, which is one of the most important ones that I try to address every single time I'm talking publicly about suicide. Even if someone is just really distressed and experiencing psychological pain, but they hadn't yet thought about suicide, it's still actually okay to ask them if they're feeling suicidal. It doesn't even introduce the idea or introduce like a new way of interpreting it. So what the research shows is like really clear that we need to start these conversations with people because it's really critical to actually keeping them safe and connecting them to any care that they may need. There are so many myths about suicide that Seth and I are constantly having to like navigate as we do work in this area. But there are several that I think are really important to understanding like kids. It's a myth that suicide is always caused by mental illness. Of course, mental illness can be a contributing factor, but one of the most important things to understand about suicide is that it results from psychological pain and hopelessness that has become like inescapable through any other means. And human suffering is incredibly complex and can have a million different sort of causes. So it's not just caused by mental illness, of course, something that Durkheim offered us, you know, over 100 years ago. But this is actually, research has even shown that in the US, like we really deeply believe that suicide is caused by mental illness. Some other things that are important to understand is that it's a myth that suicide occurs without warning. So there are often warning signs, but I will counter or sort of complicate that by just saying that sometimes it's really hard to recognize those warning signs for what they are. And this is in part, you know, because we're not good as a society, or I don't know that any society is great at this, about letting our minds go there. Like when we see someone who's suffering in front of us, whether it's your student or your child, your partner or your friend, it's just so hard to imagine losing them. And so it can be so difficult to just get to that place. Like when we've talked to families who just described their kids' suicide death as just completely out of the blue and shocking, when you start talking to them in depth, there often were a lot of warning signs. It's just they didn't know that those signs were indicating something so deep and grave, right? Mm-hmm. So it can be really important just to understand that there are often warning signs, but they can be difficult to identify. So it's important to educate ourselves long before we ever need this knowledge. And then the final thing I'll kind of raise is that there's this myth that suicide only happens to like kids with quote unquote problems, you know, kids who are engaged in other risk-taking behaviors, delinquency, drug and alcohol use, or so on and so forth. And that's just not true, again, because so many kids experience pain, for psychological pain, for so many reasons. There's not one, you know, like it can be the popular kid, it can be the straight A kid, the football star, or it can be the loner, you know, the kid who doesn't seem to have enough friends. Unfortunately, like our latest data shows that like one in five high school age kids have had thoughts of suicide in the past year. So unfortunately, to some extent, it's kind of a normal part of the human condition.
Seth, anything to add?
I think Anna covered that perfectly. I mean, it was such a textbook answer, right? It was great.
Well, that's striking, the one in five number. And those of us who have kids who are about to enter that tween teen age range and adolescence, something to think about. And one of the big, I think, important things about this book is that in my mind, it's written in such a clear and accessible way for people who are not specialists in sociology and don't have a lot of experience with this topic, but yet has a lot of good lessons for sociologists in it at the same time and resonances for our field. So I've been thinking about sharing this with my spouse, who does not have an academic position, but we share a kid, and so we're very interested in that person's health and well-being, of course.
I
That
think
was
it. Go ahead, Seth.
I
Sorry.
should say, I think that we felt that sociology, for instance, does not generally study suicide very often. And when it does, it kind of takes the approach of sort of large scale population statistics, looking at correlations between, say, recessions and suicide rates in a country or in a state or in a county. And I think that when this community invited us in and gave us so much access to people's stories and the tragedies and like the lives, like we felt that writing this in a very public facing way, in a very simple way, so that a student there or anywhere, or an adult, a parent, a school staff member, a community organizer, or a sociologist, a professional sociologist could approach it. We felt that that was sort of honoring the access that we gained and like the openness that people had. And also, recognizing that this community was reeling and had been reeling and wasn't looking for us to solve the problem per se, but got a lot of things off their chests. We're very open about getting some of that trauma out there. So I think that was part of the feeling was, how do we make this accessible, right? How do we make this something more than just the sort of typical sociology fair of suicide?
I'll just add that, like, for me, I think also part of what we did in this book is we interviewed over 100 people for the book, but a really huge proportion of them are suicide loss survivors. And so part of what allows us to do this work emotionally, as well as what allows them to like put the effort into taking the time and to go there and re-experience their story and share it, is this idea that we can use this to help make a better world for kids and to help communities heal after suicide losses. So it's also just like really personally and professionally important to make sure that the work we do is accessible to broad audiences.
I think I want to say one more thing about the book and style and the language that you use in here. Anna, you use the term psychological pain. And the language of pain and the language of suffering and the language of like the social sources of suffering. I mean, when I read sociology often these days, those are phrases I don't hear very often. And so just that kind of intervention to say what we're studying here is, it's a complex thing, but it's deeply felt, and using the term pain and suffering instead of terms that are more, I guess, general and maybe a little less material in some sense, embodied in some sense. Like pain is an embodied kind of, it's an embodied thing, right? So when we use the terms oppression or inequality or even injustice, right? These terms don't have the same kind of resonance as pain, even trauma or suffering. So if you're the kind of person who likes to have some, I mean, I guess I would say emotion in your sociology, and an embodied sense of what people are experiencing in this context, and perhaps others, if people take these kinds of terms up, this is a book for you.
I love that. It's I'll be honest with you. In part, those terms come from the clinical psychology of suicide. There's this, I mean, so Seth and I really care about doing transdisciplinary work. Like again, because we care about policy and intervention and actually, doing work that can help kids' lives be better, we read broadly. And so we've read a lot of different theories of youth suicide or even just suicide more generally. And one of the things, one of the oldest theories from, oh, Seth is better at names, but what was Schneidman's first name? I'm blanking. Edwin.
Edwin, yeah.
Edwin Schneidman, had this term term psychache, which I thought was just so brilliant. And it is still one of my favorite theories of suicide. And he's a founder of suicidology and so on and so forth. He's very famous. His theory is very famous. But we also hate jargon, right? And psychache is a bit jargony. And it's like, well, what is that, right? And so some scholars have started using psychological pain. And I do think that one of the core things that we know about suicide is that it does involve intense internal pain. People don't just die by suicide because they're mimicking, you know, or I hate that term, like imitative suicide or whatever, drives me nuts for lack of a more elegant word. But, and so I wanted to really actually acknowledge that psychological pain is in those intrapersonal processes are fundamental to suicide, but how a kid gets to that intense psychological pain can be deeply social. And if we never address those social roots, mean that sometimes make that pain inescapable, even if you survive the moment, we're going to be really missing the boat on suicide prevention. So it's both kind of a link into clinical psychology of suicide. But I also love what you've pointed out about embodiment. And of course, Seth and I love the sociology of emotions and think it's a really critical way to think about how the external social world becomes internalized.
Yeah, I completely agree. And, you know, I mean, a lot of this just reflects, I think, what has become the inadequacy of sociological explanations that, you know, Durkheim staked that strong claim that the social world is external and distant and coercive and makes us do stuff. And it doesn't really, you know, the psychological world is for psychologists and it doesn't really matter because it's too subjective and it's impossible to really study scientifically and rigorously. And we've sort of just accepted that as basic fact. And so when you see people trying to explain suicide, you know, using Durkheim, it becomes like this sort of mental wrestling, you know, or tying people, some tying yourself into a pretzel where you're like, anomie, you know, causes it. And it's like, well, what's anomie, right? And how do large scale, you know, how do looking at rates and these sort of distant forces like actually lead to people doing the things they're doing? And pain, quite frankly, is a universal thing. It's a thing that motivates people to act. It's a thing that makes them run away from, you know, things. It makes them try to escape. It also makes them try to get rid of the pain. And it also leads to them trying to avoid the pain as well. And so you can't really disentangle that, I think, anymore, right? And I just think that sociologists at some point have to, if they're going to remain relevant to like conversations, not just policy, and it matters for policy and practical stuff, but for being able to explain why things happen, they're going to have to start thinking a little bit harder about what's going on inside the body, right? And how that is connected to the, so it's not to say the social world doesn't matter, but it's to deny the body is seems silly.
All right, I'm loving it. Let's talk about Poplar Grove. What can you tell us about this community and its experience with youth suicide?
I think you can tell that Southerner. So lots of people struggle saying the word poplar. And I was just like, it's a tree. Poplars.
Oh, I will say there's a Poplar Grove, like right next to where I grew up. I went to a high school in Missouri called Ash Grove. And Poplar Grove was not very far away from us. So I was very familiar with Poplar Grove and was like, oh,
That's funny.
Pretty certain you all did not study my Poplar Grove.
No, we did not. It is a pseudonym. And, you know, one thing we've learned is there's no new name anywhere. Somewhere in the world, your name exists, whatever pseudonym you come up with, however creative you think it is. So you asked about Poplar Grove. I'll start by just describing their experience with suicide and specifically suicide clusters, which was what led the community initially to reach out to me and ask if Seth and I might be interested in doing research there to help them understand what on earth was going on. So between 2007 and about 2016, which was largely when our field work wrapped up, Poplar Grove, which is a relatively small community, lost 17 kids, both youth who were actually middle schoolers, high schoolers, and young adults who had recently graduated from the one public high school in this town. And in that time period, there were also multiple suicide clusters that actually involved three or more youth or young adults dying by suicide in a short period. The shortest period was 6 weeks. That was a really, really traumatic period where they had, I think they had actually more than three deaths in that 6 week period. Mm. And then the longest for a cluster was over the course of a school year, which if you can imagine like a high school losing three kids in one school year that were current students to suicide, like that's incredibly traumatic for a school community. But what's interesting is that even in the years where they didn't have an explicit cluster, they also lost kids, like basically between 2007 and the end of our field work, they lost at least one child or young adult to suicide every single year. And this is what's called an echo suicide cluster, because basically it becomes impossible to tell where one cluster ends and another begins, because people, even if they died as singleton suicides or isolated suicides, they were highly impacted by those earlier deaths. So that was like the situation with suicide that brought us there. And, you know, this high school is a school of like 2,000 kids, and it's very difficult to calculate suicide rates for a high school for two reasons. One, the denominator is always shifting. You don't have the same kids in the school every single year. But the second reason is, of course, it's suicide is thankfully a rare event. And 2,000 is, you know, we usually calculate rates by the 100,000. But even still, if you do some sort of wishy-washy fancy, you know, you would expect like a high school of 2000 to maybe lose a kid once every 10 years, you know, twice, okay, maybe, you know, but to have this number of kids tied to this high school die by suicide was really disproportionate. What was so surprising was when we got there, it's a beautiful place surrounded by nature and community gathering spaces, two central parks, a community center with a pool and a beautiful library and, you know, places that people really take pride in and care about. All the neighborhoods have these little parks with like frisbee golf and pools and basketball courts. Like every single one of the communities has these beautiful spaces that the community members can just gather in. And so it was very surprising, as you know, Durkheimian sociologists, to get there and find like everybody telling us we pull together, we care about each other. Kids telling us that, like, you know, if they fell off their bike and busted their knee, they could actually just go into whatever house was right there, knock on the door and say, I need help, like, I need a Band-Aid, or can you call my mom? And they had this feeling that any house, any person in their neighborhood would help them. And so then it's like, well, what's going on here? Because that's certainly not what Durkheim would have us imagine, right? When we imagine this place that's losing all of their kids to suicide. And so we began digging deeper into this. And one of the challenges in life in this beautiful community was the really intense culture. There's a very narrow set of beliefs about what a good kid and a good family looks like. And it involves some pretty high pressure stuff, being academically excellent, being highly involved in extracurriculars. And what was even sort of more interesting, I grew up in a huge city. I'm from Houston, Texas. And for everybody to just be so similar and to like care about the exact same things was just a little bit surprising to me, because I went to like a really heterogeneous high school in terms of socioeconomic status, race, ethnicity, but also just in terms of what we thought was cool and what we valued and what we did on the weekends. And that just wasn't the case in Poplar Grove. Like, I've never heard so many kids talking about how many APs this person took and how many APs the valedictorian had completed. I was like, wow, okay. So it was really homogeneous internally. But the last sort of really interesting piece of the puzzle when it comes to like describing Poplar Grove is that it was actually abnormally homogeneous. It's actually surrounded by a huge amount of socioeconomic diversity, race, ethnic diversity. Many of the communities, like in very close proximity, like we're talking like, you know, a 15-minute drive with traffic, right? They have higher populations of immigrants, but it was also the most elite community in the area. And so that homogeneous internal combined with that heterogeneity in such close proximity, and the fact that it is the most elite place in the community, all of these things just serve to like really amplify the importance and the value placed on being from Poplar Grove, right? And so they had a real reputation to maintain. So there was this really shared, you know, stake and this identity of being the best of the best, like academically, athletically, dominating state championships and so on. That's kind of a little taste of what we discovered this town to be about.
Yeah. And I would add to that, you know, so human ecologists would call this community circumscribed, or, you know, a high level of circumscription, both geographically, socially, and culturally. And so we came to describe this kind of as like a fishbowl, in a sense. You know, a lot of the kids would say, I don't know what it looks like on the outside. And when we talked with young adults who had gone to college, they were like, oh my God, my experiences when I was hanging out with my dorm mates, my experiences were just completely bonkers compared to like their experiences. And so on the one hand, right, they were sort of like closed in. And on the other hand, it was a unique community, unlike the communities that we've been in for the last 4 years, where there was no core, like no downtown area where the adults would go. In fact, it was just a big bedroom community where the adults were all the same status. They all had very high occupational prestige. They traveled out of the city to do their work. And so the center, right? All towns kind of have a center usually where, like, if you can imagine a bunch of horses are like anchored to that center, like tied up to it. Our personal identities become tied to this sort of collective center. The center was this school, and it was the football games and all the events that happened and the theater and, you know, all these things that were going on became the kids' world, and the only part of the kids' world. And for the parents, this was like their sort of status competition. So they'd be at the game, and on Saturday night or Friday night, and the conversation would be about their kids, because their kids were the status markers, not their jobs, not their incomes. And, you know, it was really, I mean, it was a fishbowl and like a pressure cooker in like two really intense ways. And these kids were just sort of stuck in between as like kind of pawns in the game, but also very active in doing that, right? They had internalized the ideas of this is what we're supposed to do, so I'm going to do it.
Well, I grew up in a very small town outside the third largest city in Missouri, which is not terribly distinguishing in of itself, that third largest city. But in any case, there are some things that resonated with me in terms of your description of Poplar Grove. There was a little downtown area in the town that I went to high school in, but there was a lot of intense involvement in high school sports and other kinds of community activities. And really the school was the thing that brought everyone together. Many people did work in that larger city I was just mentioning. That's super interesting. We'll get back to the kids and their perspective in a minute. So you've already mentioned Durkheim, and obviously a lot of us in graduate school, we read Suicide, or a lot of Suicide, or we're assigned Suicide in any case.
Pretended to read it.
And many people outside of sociology perhaps consider Suicide to be solely a personal problem. And as you mentioned, it's been a topic, you know, since Durkheim. And in your appendix, you discuss abductive analysis and the importance of finding the unexpected in your data. So what did you find about the relationship between this social cohesion, which you've mentioned in Poplar Grove, and youth suicide?
Good question. So, you know, as a refresher and to not become a sociology professor for a minute. As all of you remember, Durkheim had two basic dimensions or principles by which suicide varied. One was integration, or like levels of solidarity or connectivity or cohesion. And the other one was regulation, or like the sort of clarity and collectivity of a set of norms and values and things of that nature. But the thing that's sort of been the take-home point that has been his calling card, and this is the thing that psychologists and epidemiologists cite when they cite any sociology, they cite Durkheim, and they refer to this process of integration and the idea of connectivity being protective, being healthy, being, you know, supportive. And the CDC, right, is for connectivity. It's a very big thing. The schools that we've been in other places, at the beginning of the years when they're talking about mental health and well-being, they're talking about belongingness and like increasing trusted adults and all these other things. So connectivity is basically just a taken for granted piece of what would lead, you know, to higher rates of suicide, the lack of that connectivity. And when we got to this place, as Anna described earlier, like it you know, kids would be like, I knew all the adults on the block. And the adults would be like, I knew all the, I mean, it's like very ideal, right? Or idyllic in the sense of small town America from the 50s. And they were very genuine about it. So like we understood eventually after a couple of visits that this was a really highly connected place. And yet it had this massive, you know, enduring suicide problem. And we were only at the tip of the iceberg, right? It took us a while to figure out how many decedents there were and in what time periods, because it wasn't always clear. But you know, we weren't able to collect data on things like attempts and ideation, which of course was outside of Durkheim's interest, but still is suicidality. And, you know, we would posit that this was higher as well there. And so the surprise is, right, what is the relationship? Why does connectivity here cause or contribute to suicidality in a way that we would not expect it to? And abductive analysis is designed to, like, you go in with assumptions, theories, and for us, it was Durkheim. And you find surprises. And we literally touched down and had six focus groups each over a two-day span. I had three on Saturday and three on Sunday, and she had three on Saturday and three on Sunday. And after the first day, like that was like the theme that just kept popping. I mean, we were having conversations over wine, like being like, what is going on? Like, how could this be? This is completely counter to everything sociologists have taken to be true. And of course, it's not totally counter, right? Because Durkheim did have another form of suicide, altruistic suicide, where there's too much integration. But sociologists have largely ignored it because Durkheim said, don't worry about this. This only relates to traditional societies. It's a relic of like old mechanical relationships where, you know, it's really small, tight-knit, pre-literate societies foraging groups or something like that. And so that has been a largely unexplored piece, right? And we could start to puzzle or answer this puzzle by at least starting there.
Right. So Poplar Grove, not known for its anomie.
No.
In fact, known for precisely the opposite, very tight-knit community where everyone's looking out for each other. The description of Poplar Grove is this very ideal place and very self-conscious of its position relative to neighboring communities and its role in the state as this beacon of elite life. Okay, so out of this work, you develop a new model of adolescent suicide that links the meso or community level to the micro level with local culture that includes, as you mentioned, an intense focus on success, the pressure to be perfect, and also stigma about mental health challenges and shame. So can you unpack your theory for us a bit?
Yeah, I'll start and I'll try to kind of paint the general picture, because I think when we started to think this through, our goal was to kind of develop a theory that was not just Poplar Grove, because we recognize Poplar Grove has some comparative limitations. It's not all communities that have suicide problems are like this, you know. And so we started with the idea of integration and regulation of Durkheim's two principles. And we sort of thought of integration as sort of the structure or the connective, the social networks piece. And regulation is more like the cultural piece, like the way people see themselves, their identities, like their collective identities, the expectations that they have about who they are, the punishments that they might receive if they violate those rules. And instead of being at the macro level, right, where Durkheim's saying, okay, what are divorce rates, right, versus single people versus married people's rates of suicide, or what are Protestants and Catholics rates versus Jews? We were like, well, what about if you just scale down to a community where there is an enduring suicide problem, or a school, right? You could even go a little bit lower, and you say, you ask questions like, well, what is the structure and what is the culture and how are these things intersecting in ways that might be related to suicidality? For Poplar Grove, we've discussed how tight-knit it was, which is good. It was supportive, but it also reduced the amount of privacy that people had. It spread gossip really easily. People felt like they were being monitored at all times, even when they weren't. And then the culture, as Anna described, was super high achievement, right? It was a culture of like, you have to be the best at sports, the best at school, and the best socially. And the sort of negative directive was you can't have mental health problems. You can't be visibly mentally unhealthy because that's an imperfection. And so you had this perfect storm of this structure and culture like hitting each other. And then all you needed was what we think was the final ingredient, which was a loss of a kid who exemplified or was ideal in the community. And that then leads to the question of, well, what happened? Why did this kid die by suicide? And it's clearly not mental health, right? Because this person has been hiding any of the struggles they might have. And so the narrative then becomes, well, what caused this suicide? And eventually in this community, right, it became a story of pressure. Too much pressure led kids to die by suicide. And it, in another community, it could be a different story, right? But that's kind of like the general framework for how we thought about Poplar Grove.
Yeah, and I'll just add that like a really key part of it. So as Seth said, like having a mental health problem was seen as detract. There was a lot of mental health stigma. And so people didn't want to be open about having diagnoses or seeing therapists or struggling. But there was also like this twist on it that, you know, that other sociologists have noticed in elite schools and communities, like Seamus Khan work and privilege, like that the kids were supposed to make it look easy to be achieving at this really high level. So being stressed enough to need like psychological support was kind of antithetical to being that like ideal Poplar Grove kid. And unfortunately, what that meant is that it was really hard to seek help when you need it. And instead of seeking help when they're just anxious and stressed and feeling a bit of depression, they would just let it slide and slide and slide until it became a crisis. And we interviewed some suicide attempt survivors from the community, as well as people who had lost people they were really close to suicide. We sort of combined two methods called sociological autopsy and then like social autopsy, which there are some distinctions between those two methods, but we tried basically to triangulate multiple perspectives on why someone had died by suicide. Since the person who's gone is largely not present to share their own story with us, we have to, you know, triangulate. And that's not perfect, but it's what we can do. So we did it. And for a lot of people, they knew that they could get help. They even knew that if they reached out, that people would connect them to psychiatric care. But they either felt like that was so at odds with who they were as a person. They were supposed to be that perfect kid that made it look easy, that didn't need any help. That was just not who they were fundamentally. So even though they were surrounded by this web of support, it would invalidate their identity to such a degree that somehow attempting suicide was to them in that moment the better option.
Yeah. And I, you know, to go back to some of the question and to build off this, sociologists talk about shame, especially symbolic interactionists and micro sociologists. And like, so shame is the social emotion that one feels when they believe that their person, their self, their identity is deficient or corrupting or polluting. And it doesn't require an audience, right? Embarrassment requires like an audience to some degree. Like you trip over your foot and you look around and your face gets red and maybe people watch, maybe they didn't. But shame, you can feel that in the shower, you could feel it in your car, you could feel it at any point. And shame is essentially is triggered when we have some strong expectations that we believe others hold us to, real others or the community, and we feel like we've violated them. And so these, you know, sociologists and some psychoanalysts talk about what's called engulfed shame. And this is where people somewhat live in like a state of shame. But because in the US and in most of the West, we don't talk about shame, like we it's a very scary topic. People don't identify the shame. They think of it as depression or sadness or anxiety. But instead, what it is that they feel like they're failing. Right. And so you had kids in all different places. Some felt like they were always failing their parents or the school or themselves. Some were worried they would fail. And so they were like hyper vigilant about everything they did. And then when they did fail, right, they just felt like intense shame and there was no way to express that. And so in a lot of ways, suicidality, and I would guess, you know, we knew that there was also drug and alcohol use, but that's probably true of a lot of communities. But I think that's also in this place, suicidality, but I think more generally drug and alcohol use and other pathological behaviors like that are idioms of distress, right? They're, I can't tell right. an adult how I feel, but I see other kids doing these things, or I know this is one way to symbolically express how I feel. The problem with suicide, right, is that the final act. And for a child who doesn't have that sort of cognitive ability to see into the future, right, that they're not developed, their brain's not fully developed yet, they may not realize exactly what they're about to do. They don't understand the finality of that. And yet they're still social actors, right? They're still performing and they're still trying to express their inner subjective feelings like anybody, like we're doing right now, right? Except their feelings, as Anna noted at the very beginning, are intense pain, engulfed in shame. Right. And that just is a horrible, horrible situation for anybody.
I mean, like we had interviews with kids where they expressed, like they use such strong language to talk about like having to drop down out of honors math into like a regular class. Like that was literally so shameful that they couldn't let anybody know that they had had to do that. Of course, I was like, I mean, I didn't do that with math, but I sure did that with science when I was in high school. Like, there were so many opportunities for Seth and I to role model, like, that you don't have to be perfect. Neither of us were the straight A kids. So yeah.
There were a lot of surprises. Like, Anna and I both came from, you know, good backgrounds and like, you know, communities that were well off to some degree. And one of the things, for instance, that shocked me, one of the pieces of pressure was it became really apparent very early on that these kids had to get athletic scholarships. Like they were supposed to get a scholarship.
Or academic.
But the athletic ones were shocking to me.
There was this pressure to get scholarships to college. And I was like, wait a second, but your parents make decent money.
They could afford this 100%.
How's that going to happen? Like, what are we talking? I didn't even know what we were talking about, to be honest.
Right. Well, but it was like, you know, these are like very common wealth building strategies in the US, especially in a climate where colleges cost excessive amounts of money. And while most colleges will give a child an incredible education in the United States, right? We know that there's things that are attached, not just to the degree that you get and the map that how it matters in terms of its pedigree, but also like, again, in these Facebook conversations, and you know, you want your kid to be accepted to all of the schools so that they have their pick, but they're going to go to the one that you went to, right? But you can't just go. You need to be an incredible field hockey star or some, one of the smaller sports where a scholarship's easier to get because you're not competing against like the really big urban schools that have like great football programs or whatever. It was mind-blowing. I have two kids and now I live in Canada and the pressure is just so different here. Like kids are still stressed here, but it's completely different. They just don't care in the same way. And like my kids like grow up in a very stress-free environment as a result, you know?
I think we have to think about what future we're showing our kids and whether it looks like a future that's going to leave them crippled in debt. Or, I mean, we could go darker, right? Like with our more recent work, we've been doing interviews with kids about what it's like to go through lockdown drills and what it's like to live in the shadow of school shootings. And, and there's other societal challenges that I'm sure you guys discuss with other sociologists, from climate change to just economic downturns to like the political debates and, intense political debates that we're having in our country right now. All of those things destabilize the future for kids. All of those things undermine their ability to imagine a happy, healthy, meaningful future. And that is a big problem. It also creates pressure for parents. I do want to be like a little conscientious that the parents are also embedded in a bigger system. And we all know that even upper middle class parents can struggle to pay for college in this day and age, but because it's just gotten so astronomically expensive, even at public schools. But this was a situation that just was really not. Parents were pushing their kids toward that stable middle class lifestyle that they had been able to achieve it through their own life course story, but it had some unintended consequences that were pretty dire.
Yeah, I mean, things changed. When I was a kid in high school, even before high school, I knew that in the breakfast club, everybody had their clique and station. The athletes were the athletes, and like the bright kids were on like the yearbook and journalism squad, and like music kids were in the music places, and like the theater kids were in the theater kids. But in this community, and I've seen this in other places now, like you were supposed to be on a sports team, but then you were also supposed to be the lead in the theater play, and you were supposed to do the rock band, right? The rock contest that they would. I mean, it's just, I don't know how anybody has any time for anything, right? Let alone sleep. And, sleep, of course, is a major risk factor of suicide. And so you think about how you have to fill out these college applications and you have to check all the boxes, and like this is an arms race to somewhere. And then you wonder, like, what's going to happen with the next set of kids, right? Like, it's the same in our discipline. When Anna and I were graduating with our PhDs, having one or two publications would get you a job interview. And now,
Maybe. I think I feel like that's like was like three by the time I graduated. I mean, I didn't have three for the record, but or
maybe
not
three,
three first
maybe three.
author,
But
but
then, after that
yeah.
was after the recession and the bottleneck, all those people were ended up in postdocs. And the next thing you have to have like an AP going up for tenure, basically, to get a job now. And it's just, right? So what happens next? I mean, you can't keep going. The system can't be a hamster wheel, right? Otherwise, there's consequences for
Ooh, that's a lot. Okay.
I know. I was like, we just hit you with so much.
No, it's great.
Sorry.
It's really, really great. It's really great. I want to go back a little bit and talk about how young people had internalized the message that they needed to excel in academics, athletics, or the arts, and something else in order to prepare themselves for college and to make enough money, reproduce their generally affluent lifestyles. So messing up, even if it went undiscovered, was unacceptable. So you've talked about that and this sense of shame that doesn't have to have an audience. But I want to talk about the resistors. Are there some kids who resist this? And if so, to what extent?
Yeah, the resistors, we call them our cultural rebels. I have a soft spot for them. It's funny every once in a while to realize like these are not just characters, these are real people to us, which I suppose this is my first ethnography to write up, right? So for me, it's the first time to know both the people and the characters. So there is a group of kids who really did a lot of work to reject the local culture. As you would expect, right? Like I have studied my entire career adolescent society, right? And one of the interesting things was there were cliques and, crowds and different peer groups in Poplar Grove High, but what they rarely escaped, they rarely rejected the directive to be academically, athletically, extracurricularly excellent. There was a group that we call the cultural rebels, and the key thing about them was that they saw the culture as not good for kids. And so they did a lot of personal work, often supported by their parents or by a key mentor, an adult mentor, to reject the local culture. And they often talked about it like so sociologically, like, I see the culture, I see what it's doing to kids. They even would sometimes say, like, it's killing kids. I'm not going to buy in. I'm not doing this. But the sad thing about this group of kids, as beautiful and interesting and resilient as they are, was that each and every one of them still showed signs of just how difficult it was to just categorically reject the culture. Every single one of them still showed signs of it impacting their self-esteem or their sense of being able to move into a future that was happy and successful, broadly defined, you know? And so I think that we use them to kind of illustrate that in this particular kind of context where it is so interconnected and where it is so homogeneous, even for the kids who do the work, even for the kids who do the work with the support of meaningful adults in their life, it's still just so deeply internalized that this is what's good and you are failing to meet the good expectations. And so it was basically like this constant rub for them. Like every single day they had to wake up and be like, I am good. I'm okay. My way of living is okay. So it's sort of like rebellion is possible, but it took a lot of effort and it wasn't a complete rebellion. It was kind of like an ongoing project they never fully completed.
Yeah. I mean, not to go back to my Breakfast Club analogy, but I feel like that's a go great there. Analogy.
Go there, Seth.
Thank you. Thank you. So, you know, I made this statement that, you know, everybody was in their clique and they knew where their clique was and what they did. But if you recall, and I mean, it's a movie, I know it's Hollywood, but even, you know, the real rebel in the room had internalized what the norm was, and he was rebelling against that. And he still had feelings and he still, you know, he had home trauma and all these other things that like factored into his inability to be, you know, a part of the school and the shame that he was already bringing with him. And so it's in a community like Poplar Grove, unlike I think in Breakfast Club, in a community like Poplar Grove, where there's no escaping this, right? It's really, really hard on kids. But I would, you know, posit that even in a large urban school with like, you know, 1,500 kids or more, where you can actually find your alternative spaces and you can actually find that connection with more kids who are like you, there's still some of that, like, you know, resonance of what the ideal is. And you may not like it and you may be able to escape it a lot easier in those spaces. But I just think that, you know, this is a sociological fact, right? We inhabit these life worlds, and no matter what we want to believe, we still are products of them and they still impose that on us.
There's a lot of power in belonging, you know, and creating like true belonging for diverse kids, no matter what their background is. Like that's something that since we did this field work in Poplar Grove, Seth and I have actually completed field work in two other school districts. And across the board, one of just the things that kids need just so deeply is a sense of belonging. Even if they have failed, even if they've broken the law, even if they're just unable to come to class or unable to get the grades, you know, or whatever it is, kids really need us to build worlds where they can find belonging without having to adjust or edit themselves.
Yeah, that's the hardest part of our research. The shame that I see is that the debates that we have at the societal level, in public debates, political debates about this and that, and what schools should be doing, what they shouldn't be doing, whose rights matter and whose rights don't matter, and blah, blah, blah. The thing that is being forgotten is that these kids are like living in like these worlds, and we're either making them better, we're not making them better, right? And it's funny how much we talk about like giving basic decency to people and like, you know, just being nice. Some people just can't get over that piece. And we see that when we're in these schools, we just see how hard most of the staff are working to make the lives better. And they're running against these countercurrents, right? That have nothing to do with what's going on in the building.
Well, you just mentioned that the young people that you talked to really had almost like a professional sociological view on this, and that really came through. And I think it's awesome and amazing that these young people seem to have the most accurate views of Poplar Grove and its culture. And yet they were not actively involved in suicide prevention by parents and other authorities. Why not?
That's a good question. I mean, there are more general pieces to it. I mean, specific to Poplar Grove, one of our chapters we discussed like the response that the schools had to a suicide and to the sort of the event and the aftermath of it. And I think that the community, because of how it saw itself, struggled with imperfections, just like the kids and the adults struggled with imperfections. And so it didn't want to talk about it. It exemplified the myth that talking about it might cause, kids would talk about a cascading effect or a ripple effect. And so the school just didn't know what to do, right? And it didn't do it well when it dealt with it. And a lot of the kids had endured three, four, five suicides, either when they were in elementary school and their siblings did, or they knew kids themselves during a cluster. And so as the school did this repeatedly, as the community did this repeatedly, the sense was that they just wanted to sweep this under the rug. And they didn't feel like that anyone was listening to them. And they didn't feel like the response was, helping anybody. So in a weird sense, there wasn't any adults in the room to listen to them or to sort of respond to this, to post-vent. And so, the usual things where kids and adults are kind of mistrustful of each other in school settings was just amplified here. Because of just a series of responses. And the biggest limitation I'd say to our study was we only spoke to the people who we could speak to. And there were lots of people who I assume either don't think there's a problem at all, or if they think there's a problem, it's not their kid, right? It's kind of like drugs or teen pregnancy. It's not my kid that's the problem. And so I'm just going to make sure my kid gets the schooling they need. The school shouldn't be dealing with that stuff. It should be making sure those AP courses are available and my kid gets to Harvard or Penn State or wherever they're going to go. So, like, who's going to listen, right? Where is the listening going on?
Yeah, there were times when like the kids tried to organize things, but they just got squashed or fizzled out, or they weren't allowed to do what they wanted to do. And there just wasn't a really healthy way to have dialogue to talk to kids about like, well, I appreciate that you want to do that, but we actually have concerns. These are our concerns. Because, and that's like a constant theme when there's been a suicide loss. Memorializing someone who's died by suicide is just incredibly tricky and just requires so much like thought and honestly expertise. And I've spent over a decade now thinking just about how do we handle postvention. And even I still struggle with some of the questions that schools will randomly ask me, like, is this safe? Is this not? It's like most of the time I have to be like, well, I don't really know. We don't have the research, but let me tell you some ideas. So I just want to honor that this is really difficult. But what's really not helpful is not having some way of having conversations. There were experts at the local public health department or the local crisis center, or even there's like a suicide, another suicide prevention group. So there are people who could have been invited in to facilitate these conversations while keeping people as safe as we possibly can. It's just basically important to talk, stick to the facts, like not stigmatize suicide, not stigmatize help seeking or mental illness, not glorify or romanticize suicide. But that just wasn't happening. And kids then, as Seth said, they just felt more and more alienated and like they were being collectively gaslit. So, oh yeah, there's no problem here, but we just happen to have personally known five people who've died by suicide. And it's absolutely what Seth said was like when I went back after our first big publication came out and did a presentation to like 200 community parents. And yeah, some of them absolutely did not know that suicide was a problem in the community. And it actually partially has to do with how we report suicide rates and the trick of it being such a small denominator when you have a small town that doesn't have 100,000 people in it, and the way the state was reporting the distribution of suicides was masking the fact that all of the kids were from this one high school. And so if we ask the question, well, what high school did this person go to instead of what zip code do they live? You would then be able to identify, oh, wow, we do really have a pattern here. A disproportionate number of our suicides are coming from this one high school, which did not have any magnet program. It was just a neighborhood school. So all of those things contributed to people being able to be like, la, 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 there's no problem here. Everything's fine. Our children are having an ideal childhood, unless it got really close to their family, right? And their child lost a friend or a close classmate, or even the family lost or their own child or had their child attacked.
And, you know, just to think about that, to step back and think of sort of a meta story that Anna's telling that just hit me is that the way we collect data on suicide, the way we study suicide in the social sciences broad is very problematic and has not evolved much in the last 80 years or whatnot. Psychologists generally do clinical work. That's where they have access to people who are in either, you know, psych ERs or like patients of their own that they're working with. People get referred to them. There's some experimental stuff, right? You know, a lot of funding has moved towards molecular biology and neuroscience to try and see if there's a way to predict what the brain is doing. And then sociologists and epidemiologists, right, continue to either use existing state level or governmental data, or they collect sort of macro level data. And there's just this whole middle of the world where basically what you find are these one-off community-based ethnographies. Some people at McGill University who've studied certain indigenous communities in Canada that have had serious suicide problems, either among youth or more generally in the community. You know, you'll find studies of like army bases or islands where there's been these cluster suicides, but there isn't really a lot of systematic research in that sort of meso or middle space of where most of the action is at. And it's not to say that the other methods are not important. They are, right? There's great insights that we learn, but there seems to be this missing piece of, okay, we've got zip code data, but like there's a school or a small community where this has been an enduring problem. Like what's going on there? And how does that compare to, as you know, we know of places in the news like Palo Alto had two clusters, right? And again, very similar to Poplar Grove, very affluent adults, you know, a lot of professors from Stanford, the tech industry, and, you know, clusters happened there. And that was big in the media for a minute. And then, you know, it didn't happen again. But why, right? That's not what sociologists are at. I mean, they don't ask many questions about suicide, but when they do, that's not how they ask the question.
Your approach here does remind me of some other recent books that tackle other social problems. Hirsch and Kahn's Sexual Citizens, which takes a more social ecological approach, really came through for me as well. But that is one of those things, you know, colleges are also one of these organizations that we have multiple suicides in the past few years. And also institutions or organizations that have taken proactive steps to reduce the risk or reduce physical barriers, other kinds of things that try to make changes to the landscape to protect people's lives.
Yeah. Well, and I'll tell you, when you don't have that research, and it's good that this research has started, this is where the action is at, right? Where people live their lives. If you don't have that research, then when something happens, what are you going to draw on to respond? And, you know, this is Anna and I's clarion call at this point, is like the way that people do suicide prevention was developed not in schools. So it works for the general population to some degree. But what happens when you're tailoring it to a school where people are in a unique biological, cognitive, developmental stage, where it's a not a total institution in the Goffmanian sense, but it's like a very closed everyday world that these kids spend most of their lives in. And, you know, and yet sociologists are very well positioned to study that stuff, right? We have the tools to do that social ecological stuff at the meso level. And yet we don't spend a lot of time doing it. And I know it's expensive and it takes a lot of time and whatnot, but it just seems so right up our alley.
I have a feeling we're going to draw some of these themes together here as we get closer to the end of our time. Anna, you mentioned postvention. And an important part of your book talks about how the Poplar Grove community came together after completed suicides, during funeral services, and with the school providing some limited resources. So you already mentioned that you get requests for consultation and things like that. So what kinds of things should tightly knit communities do in response to events like these?
You know, for me, that was one of the most difficult chapters to write. It was actually the last chapter we wrote before finishing the book. But now it's actually one of my favorites. And it's because this is such a difficult topic. So in some ways, I can't just set out a couple, like a bunch of guidelines, right? But I can give people things to think about. And one of the things that I think is really important to remember is that we have to grieve and kids have to grieve. So the solution cannot be not having mourning rituals, not having vigils, ignoring what has happened. That can be extremely traumatic for kids. And what we found is that it also just pushes the conversations underground. So it's important to acknowledge that we do need to have collective mourning so that we can honor the person who's gone. We can process our emotions. We can get connected to support and care. And this does need to happen both in the school building and beyond, because there's some things that are less appropriate to do in a school building. I'm personally not a huge fan of erecting physical memorials for any child who's died while a student at a school. And I'm very careful to specify any child, because if you do erect memorials for students who've died from some causes, then I'm actually going to argue, well, you had better erect memorials no matter what that child died of, including suicide, because otherwise you are stigmatizing suicide and you're labeling that death as not worthy of being memorialized. So I do really encourage schools as well as communities to be really thoughtful about policies that they develop around physical memorials. Temporary memorials are a little bit easier, although they can be really emotional for kids to have to walk by a physical memorial, even if it's only temporary. You know, that said, we did have some really powerful experiences that I do believe are positive, that were collective mourning rituals. And one of the most powerful that we witnessed, and actually that also our interlocutors like referenced independently, are the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention's Out of Darkness walks. And these walks are usually organized all around the United States. And they're usually people are walking in honor of somebody they've lost to suicide, or sometimes they walk to bring awareness to their own struggles with suicidality. But the purpose of the walk is really to raise awareness about the importance of suicide prevention and to really take up space in our communities. Like you literally walk down streets and, you know, and through a community to shed light on this really important social problem. But one of the things that we found about these walks is like, yes, people are crying there. They're often wearing clothing or doing other ways of like physically honoring the memory of the person that they loved and that they lost to suicide. But they're also combined with experts in suicide prevention who are providing education and information about help seeking. And then the really interesting thing that we found that is actually, I'll share, this is the kids who contributed to this book. This is their favorite thing that we found and the thing that they most enjoyed reading about. And that is that we found that when kids witnessed the grief of the families who lost their children to suicide, that was a really powerful experience for them and even actually created safety for them. It made them less likely to die by suicide, seeing what it did to the families. And so we called this like, instead of a social contagion effect, after being exposed to suicide, these kids were actually socially inoculated against suicide because the pain that suicides cause became so much more real. And what's interesting is it wasn't their own grief. That wasn't what did this. It wasn't how much they could empathize with the person who died by suicide or how much they identified or admired that person. It wasn't how angry they were, or whether they thought that person's choice, quote unquote, was justified. That's language that a lot of youth used when they were talking with us. It really was exposure to grieving families that did it. And so we had a family share the text of what they had read at their child's memorial service. Like we made the choice to not attend any memorial services in person. We just did not think that was appropriate, even if they were public and open. It just was like, this is not the place for research. This is a place for grief and humanity. But they shared the message that they wrote about losing their daughter. And they were so open about mental illness. They were so open about how important it is to get help. And they were so vulnerable and authentic about how much pain they were in losing their daughter, who we call Aria. And that really had a ripple effect through the community and really started conversations. And in fact, Aria's death was not followed by a suicide cluster, one of the only high profile deaths that we observed or recorded data about that did not have a cluster follow it. And so that's just one piece of evidence. We found other evidence of inoculation, but I think it's really important to think about how in these moments of intense pain, we can give back to the other kids, even to our own families, right? If we experience a loss. And there is this hope. The kids love this story because it's like growth out of a traumatic, terrible experience rather than just the pain and stress that they endured. And so I think that's why it's one of their favorite findings.
I want to ask kind of a meta question. You were invited into this community and you presented your findings and other work several times there. What have you all learned about research like this that has a strong problem solving and community engagement focus?
I love doing problem solving sociology. And I have discovered the longer we've done work in this area that if I am not community engaged, I'm missing a crucial part of the story, and I'm making my own research harder on myself by not starting with some really intense listening about what communities need from their perspective. There are some downsides. I remember that there was one talk I gave back in Poplar Grove where there were some intense emotions directed my way by parents disagreeing with some of the, really it was how they interpreted things I was saying. Like they thought I was telling them to not celebrate their children. And I was like, well, I would never say that. I would never say that. I love celebrating the children in my life. But I am saying, do you have to post it on Facebook, which was the big place where families were posting during our field work and probably still are, but maybe they've spread to other other venues. But I was also just like, and I asked them to just keep in mind that posting publicly, kids also notice what you don't post about them, right? They notice the silence, and that sends a message too. So if you want to post about all your child's successes, just also make sure that you pay attention to all the silences. Like if you have one sometimes really successful kid, or like, I don't even know, what if that kid hits a rough spot? You know, we're communicating public, private, secret, not secret to kids. And we need to really be careful about those messages. It's nerve-wracking. Seth and I actually just got back from presenting 14 times in 1 week to the latest community that we're working with. And like, that's like hour-long presentations. Like I was very hoarse by the end of the week, but it's both beautiful to see your research engaged with by the people who are at the heart of your study. Seth and I were, at the last night, we went out to dinner to kind of just, you know, celebrate a little. And we were like, I don't know that we have ever, probably this 1 week in our career, we've had a bigger impact on the real world than the rest of our career combined. But it's hard. People don't always agree, or sometimes you have to say things that are difficult. But in the end, I just really firmly believe that this is the strongest way to do science that actually results in interventions that are meaningful and that can be used and that actually matter to the communities involved. And of course, going forward, we move to different communities, because I wouldn't want to suggest interventions everywhere on the basis of one community and its idiosyncrasies. But we've learned a lot, and we've had, you know, you go in with assumptions that you don't even realize you have that are based on your training, your background, your interests, your own personal experiences, or maybe your naive understandings. Maybe you don't understand all the myths about suicide, or maybe you have your own ideas about how schools work, right? And so being community engaged is one way to check your assumptions and make sure that you're really doing strong science for the public good.
Yeah, I would second all of that. I mean, it's very bizarre for me. I was, as a graduate student, very much interested in theory and Mesopotamia from 5,000 years ago. And, you know, the evolution of religion like 2,500 years ago. I mean, these were the things I was interested in. And when I wasn't interested in them, I was still interested in much more arm's length abstractions, right? And I still write a lot of theory like that. And I'm still very much interested in the bigger processes. But, you know, this has been such a gratifying experience in the sense of you go somewhere, and we spent all this time in this community, in a community that I don't know whether I necessarily live in. It wasn't a community that I grew up in. And I spent basically a week here, a week there in two high schools all the time in people's lives, like just sitting around waiting for a kid to come into a counselor's office or an administrator's office, walking around the school and, you know, hearing about these people's lives. And they were so amazing about letting us in and seeing their world. And then to come back like we did a couple of weeks ago and to have this reunion of sorts with all these people who were more than just our subjects, but then to deliver this thing and to see them actually, they had been reading it and they all had come with the executive statement and had tabs on it and highlights, and like to be so serious about like, well, maybe this will make some change. You know, who knows what the change would be and whether it will be total or whether it can even fix things, but to see it as part of a motivating force that was animating these groups that what we had seen somewhat like were islands unto themselves to come together more was really awesome. And I don't know whether that's always the case, but I would say that it's probably, as Anna said, maybe the only time in my career that this may ever happen like this. And I think it's worth it for anybody to go through this. Like, you know, it's just, we spend a lot of time distant from the things we study just because of the nature of sociology and statistics and even our interview methods. But this, there's just something nice. And it's like something that I, you know, we can win awards or be tenured or whatever, but this will be something I won't forget anytime soon.
And just to clarify, when Seth referenced the two high schools, that's our most recent project, mm-hmm. which we yeah. call the community Western Slope, Colorado, not Poplar Grove. Alas, Poplar, we were yeah. not, we did not have two high schools to compare during the, our field work back then.
And we were
when we had moms, we had, yeah, we were babies. We had no budget.
And you know, how's the sausage made? I mean, like we were using exactly how you would study suicide by a sociologist. We were using the adolescent health data, doing longitudinal quantitative stuff. And both of us, we exhausted the data set and it popped a bunch of questions like what we were studying about contagion, dyadic contagion, you know, the spread of suicide from family or friends to another person. We're like, well, we can't get at the mechanisms. So we just started asking, you know, we developed an interview guide, started asking questions, and it was sort of serendipitous that we ended up in Poplar Grove. And we weren't even there to study clusters. We were there because we were still interested in contagion. And it was just, we were inundated that first weekend and we were like, that's what we're studying. We need to change the interview guides. We need to alter a thing. And it was all on the fly with no money. And we would do things probably a million times differently, right? And we did. But yeah, it's just one of those weird, that's kind of like the sausage making story. Neither here nor there, but interesting nonetheless.
We crashed on my childhood friends. Seth slept on her futon and I slept in her like guest bedroom. Uh-huh. Like she lived an hour away. We just got lucky. Like that's how little money we had.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the good news about science is that this is a collective enterprise, right? So just because you all have done this study does not mean that anyone else is prohibited from finding a community that varies in some significant way from Poplar Grove and going and doing something that is, you know, structurally very similar, but may have different outcomes. You might find different sort of community characteristics, these social ecological characteristics that are going to be differently important in a different context.
Absolutely.
You know, science is a team sport. And so we should celebrate that when this team that I'm talking to now has a win and publishes an Oxford University Press book, then great. We say, congratulations, you know, and we're all going to read it and be better for it. But that doesn't mean this is the final word. And I don't think anyone who does this, you know, professionally or even avocationally would think that anything that they write is the final word on a topic, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Totally agree.
All right. Well, I want to move towards my last question before we get on to banter, which is always fun. But it may sound odd to say, but your book appears at a time when youth and young adult suicide seem to be having a cultural moment. Just in late January 2024, the New York Times published a long piece about several suicides at Worcester Polytechnic Institution in Massachusetts. And late last year, they published a piece on suicide prevention efforts at the Golden Gate Bridge in California, where the bridge finally got some suicide barriers after many, 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 many years and many completed suicides. And you're both going to be in New York City on May 6th later this year at the 92nd Street Y to talk about your book with Malcolm Gladwell, who I'm sure many people are familiar with. What do you think is drawing such attention to this topic at this moment in time?
Well, there are a number of factors. I mean, I'd say one thing, you know, there's a little strand of phenomenological research on bereavement and grieving that shows that sudden, unpredicted deaths like heart attacks or car accidents or suicide are very, very powerful forces of meaning-making projects that those who are grieving have to engage collectively to kind of make sense of these things. And this is why clusters, I think, matter so much to communities or schools, because they're such powerful events. But you then add in the fact that the last 20, 25 years have been defined by the internet becoming something that is not just a chat room, but a ubiquitous web of social relationships. The rise of social media, which is really fascinating. And people ask Anna and I this question all the time. We talk about Poplar Grove because it's not in the book. People are like, well, what about social media? And I have to remind them that just 10 years ago, Facebook was popular. Instagram was still just a picture website, right? We mostly used it for artistic things of like food and friends. And like Snapchat was not that real. Like Vine was around, but like a lot of the Twitter was just really getting started. It wasn't quite what it was today, right? And it wasn't that people weren't using it. It just didn't have the same kind of impact. But over that 10 years, the salience of any kinds of topics, especially things that are related to school violence, whether school shootings or suicide clusters, has grown, right? And then you add to this that in the last just 15, 20 years, and even more so in the last 10 years, youth that were previously somewhat protected or were not really the likely people to die by suicide, like Black boys and Black girls or girls in general, have now grown exponentially. Right now, in absolute numbers, they're still not quite as high as white boys, but generally speaking, they have grown tremendously. And that, so now it's not just one type of person's problems. It's become a problem for youth. So of course, then the questions are, is what's causing it? Social media, right? A lot of research studying like what social media does in terms of depression and anxiety and whether it has an impact on it. So that's like added to the sort of sound. And then you add to the fact one more piece that places like Germany and France have social media, just like the United States, and they don't have the same increases in suicide rates. In many cases, they've either plateaued or declined. And so the question is, what makes America so exceptional? What's the big deal? And you add high profile clusters and yeah, we're talking about it, right? Youth seem to be in crisis. COVID happened and everyone asked, well, what the hell did COVID do to people, right? School shootings have it's not just Columbine, like a one-off. It's now like a regular occurrence in the media. And so, you know, I think this just fits into the larger piece of like youth in crisis. And what we can do about that.
I think it's hard to look at the increases in youth suicide rates that we've seen in our country largely since 2007 and not begin to pay more attention, right? But I think all of this got really amplified when the pandemic hit and kids were, you know, pretty affected by it. I want to be careful to like not, I think it's, we're not going to fully understand the impact of the pandemic on kids' mental health for a couple years to come as we like collect and analyze the data, not us personally, but as public health scholars and other sociologists and folks working on youth well-being. It certainly drew a lot of questions, you know, like in one school district that we were working in, most kids did fine. They did a little survey with their student body, but there was a group of kids who actually did way better being at home during the pandemic. Probably they were getting to escape those high pressure, you know, and in that district, they stopped grades for a bit. They just pass fail. But there was another group of kids for whom home was not as safe and secure, right? And so it's pretty important to remember that it's not going to be a singular pathway of how the pandemic impacted kids' health, but it certainly triggered a conversation, right? A change in the conversation that we're having about kids' mental health. And I think it made us much more aware that what happens in schools impacts not only kids' academic outcomes, but also their well-being, their mental health, and even their life chances in terms of a broader sort of happiness and healthiness metric. So, I mean, in some ways, it's very exciting. I think for me, the question is like, do we use this moment for collective good? Or do we just use it to instill panic in schools and parents and teachers? And I'm not always like a massive optimist, but I do try to be solutions oriented. Let's take this moment for what it is. Let's be careful. I don't think people need to panic, but I do think we need to be thoughtful about the kind of childhood and adolescence that we want to be providing our kids.
Right. I think one thing that comes across in your book is just the need for a diverse set of pathways for models of failure, or at least setbacks that are not fatal, but are turning down the temperature on all of these status competitions and athletic competitions and trying to refocus on doing things because they are fun, they are enjoyable, you know, you develop skills, but you don't do them because you're trying to fill out a resume or get into Princeton or get a merit scholarship or an athletic scholarship. Seth was saying earlier, like, where does this stuff end? You know, really there are hard limits to the kinds of things that people are capable of doing and that we should ask of people, not only young people, but everyone, obviously, to the extent that we can make these pathways available so it's okay not to be perfect all the time and to recognize that setbacks are part of a process, which must be particularly hard for communities where there are a bunch of CEOs and very, very wealthy lawyers and doctors and people who have achieved the pinnacle of their careers.
I know one of the things I always like to encourage people to start small, you know, like some of these things can feel so entrenched and they are, but I think that we can also touch kids' lives in one conversation through one purposeful moment of role modeling. And so like one thing that Seth and I always did, and thankfully we had so many moments of imperfection to draw on, but I always tried to talk really explicitly with kids who perceived me and Seth to be like incredibly successful. And yes, I think we are.
You
right?
are. Yeah. You are. We were, you're successful. You
know, we were much earlier in our careers when we were face to face with these kids. But even then we were both professors, you know, we were doing our own work. We were doing work that appealed to them, that they thought was really cool and interesting, right? But I used to just talk with kids, you know, and we actually do this in the book too. We very deliberately role model certain things, like the fact that Seth and I both go to therapy. If not this moment, we have gone to therapy for many years of our lives. But I would always just talk to kids about that time that I got a 13 on an exam. And I was like, well, this is the new life experience, or the time in college where I left an exam in my major in a required course, 2/3 blank. And I was just like, again, I guess this is going to be a life experience. And I think one of the great gifts that my family gave me was just an emphasis on curiosity and learning and doing the best I can, rather than an emphasis on grades or whatever. And so those were really stressful days when I got those grades, but I didn't feel like my life was over. I felt like whatever came next, I'd be able to manage it. And I think that when we share those moments of vulnerability, it can be really helpful. I think we do this also. Seth and I run a lab group together. We have like weekly meetings. And we also take care to create a culture of collaboration and celebration of each other's successes and openness about our struggles, our concerns, and clarity that failures are not, they're not even irregular, right? Like Seth and I just had a major paper rejected that was really a big bummer because we poured our heart and soul into this paper. But guess what? That happens. And it isn't even necessarily unfair, right? It's unfortunately a normal part of publishing. It's not all Malcolm Gladwell and like, you know, beautiful book covers. It's also the grind. And we shared our disappointment. We shared how we felt. And we also shared how we're going to move on.
Yeah. In this field, if you aren't failing, you aren't trying.
Yeah.
Oh, 100%. I mean, and that's true of all fields of whatever things you're trying to master are filled with setbacks and steps backwards and failures. And in fact, the failures are often like sites of true character building and the sites of possible creative serendipity. So I'm always wary of thinking in terms of macro terms of societal change, because I think Anna's right. Like these things are entrenched, like systems are complex and they're not even systems. Like we use the word system, which something that is just there. We're not going to change all the universities and their standards for what they expect. And we can't change what has to be done in order to get into them. But modeling failure, yeah, I try to do that with my graduate students all the time. And, you know, on top of that, things that we learn from the kids that we listen to, things like, okay, what my parents used to say to me, don't worry, when you're out of high school, life will be better. For these kids, and maybe I didn't even realize it at the time, but for these kids, what you're saying to them is that trying to make their world better is not a priority right now. Just wait till later, right? And that's not to say, right, we're always cautious about saying we can't, it's not like we can make everything bubblegum and unicorns and like umbrellas with beautiful balloons on them. But what we can do is to be like, I hear you. And yes, we do want to make your life better, right? We do want to actually improve this. And it might not end up being perfect, but we are going to try and work on this. And we want to hear from you, right? We want it to be collaborative so far as we can within state guidelines and district policies and school, you know, reality as well. And I think kids react to that, right? I think they respond to not being told, you know, they know they're the ones that are doing shooter drills. They know that life's, you're not going to just suddenly get rid of shooters, right?
Yeah.
But they also hear you as a person talking to them as a person. And that's really important.
Well, you got to level with them.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So speaking of leveling, we're running up against the time that I'm going to be kicked out of this recording room. I did want to move, first of all, thanks again, and wanted to move quickly to the banter segment. One of the things we talked about before we hit the record button was the ASA annual meeting in 2025. Do we have any speculations about where it's going to be? Those of us who are ASA members got that email about 2025 destination is coming, but it's not here yet.
I know. It's so irregular.
So irregular. I mean, the last time something happened this last minute, right, we ended up in Vegas.
Memorable conference if there ever was.
I didn't go to that when I was moving from California to Memphis for my job. But if you're thinking about the most likely, if they had to do it on the fly, that would be where I would guess, because they have so much space there. But I have no idea. I thought there was a place. This was news to me. Dan, when you brought this to my attention today. Anna, do you have
I
any
mean,
speculations
all I
on
can
this?
say is that like I hated ASA in Vegas. I was like so overstimulated, but I was also in the process of moving. So maybe if I had more emotional resources, I wouldn't get quite so overwhelmed by all of the noise and lights and glitter and whatever. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm curious whether it'll go online, based on that new policy and that they put out saying that we were going to go online every 3 years, but I thought they weren't starting that till much later. But then seeing that there's no place assigned is sort of interesting.
Well, 2012 was very memorable to me because that's when I learned about the job opening that I eventually took. Actually, that was 2011, wasn't it?
Yes, 2011.
It
Yeah,
was.
okay. So I learned about the job I would eventually take in the fall of 2012 while I was at the ASA meeting in Las Vegas.
Oh, awesome.
In any case, where would you like to see the ASA meeting where it has not been, at least hasn't been recently? Seth, where would you like to see it?
Okay, my top five lists. Vancouver, because I live here and it's awesome. San Diego, because why are we not going to? It's like the greatest city in the face of the planet and it's built for conventions, right? Number three, Detroit, because Detroit has really rebounded. And I lived in Michigan for a long time and it's weird that we don't go there for the fact that we're all about, supporting communities. This is a community that's like really kind of on the rise and pulled itself up. Memphis, because I lived there and quite frankly, I'd like to eat some good barbecue again. And it's a cool town. And then if I had to pick one, I would be stuck between Savannah, which is impossible because it's too small, but Charleston, because it's a gorgeous town. And I know Anna will tell me it's so muggy and hot and humid. But you know what? Vegas, it was like 100 and something degrees. And yeah, so
The
that's
dry
where I would
heat.
go. Dry heat. It doesn't matter. You're in the convention all day, right?
All right, Anna, do you have top five?
I don't know that I have top five, but I'll tell you, I would really prefer that. I don't like going back to the same cities over and over and over. So, like, Los Angeles was like a welcome change from San Francisco, as much as I love San Francisco, right? But I think it would be great. I mean, I'd be really excited to go to like Minneapolis or Denver. As someone from Texas, I am aware of just how incredibly hot and humid the American South can be. So, I'm a little less enthusiastic about like Charleston or Houston or even Memphis, even though they're magnificent cities. And I do understand the political concerns of going to some places, but I like a little variety. Portland, Oregon, I don't know. Seattle was fun, I think I like the novelty.
I could get behind Portland.
I would love to see more Canadian cities too, not only Vancouver. I mean, Montreal's lovely. I've enjoyed Montreal every time I've been there. We've not been to Toronto as far as I know, which would be very interesting. And then, of course, some of these other cities that you mentioned, I think would be lovely to go to as well, recognizing the constraints that ASA is under. And no one is, don't at us here, ASA or ASA leadership, because we are certainly aware of how complex it is and how many value considerations there are when planning the annual meeting. And I won't speak for these two, but I appreciate all of the work that goes into this as someone who has been working on some conferences for the Pacific Sociological
Absolutely.
Association, which, by the way, will be in San Diego this year.
I
FYI.
like the PSA. PSA is great.
All right. Thanks so much to both of you. I really appreciate the time. And thanks so much for this book. I hope it gets a lot of readership and makes a difference in communities because this is an important issue that you're working on. And I know there's more to come from both of you.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
You've been listening to the Annex, a sociology podcast. This is Dan Morrison from the University of Alabama in Huntsville. Thanks to my guests. Thanks to Joe Cohen, who directs the Queen's Podcast Lab at the City University of New York. Thanks to our producers, and thanks to Lena Orsa for the music. We'll see you next time.